it's good to chat for a minute. Why did we come here? And did we have the idea, oh, I'm going to do something virtuous? Or did we just come because it's Friday night or Saturday morning, wherever you are, and that's what you do? What was our just basic motivation for being here this evening? And so whatever it was or is, it's good to build on it and expand it, so that we expand our heart outwards to include all living beings, wanting them to be free of misery. And we expand our heart upwards with the aspiration to attain full awakening and come to have the four Buddha bodies through which we can fulfill our own purposes and the purposes of others. And so with that motivation, then we'll listen this evening. Last night we talked a little bit about the four Buddha bodies, the four kayas, and it said that the first two fulfill our own purpose or our own aim. So in other words, the two dharma kayas, nature truth body and the wisdom truth body, fulfill our own aim. And the two form bodies, enjoyment body and emanation body, fulfill the aims or purposes of others. So what this means, you know, because sometimes we think, oh, getting enlightened, we just do everything for sentient beings. I'm just like zero, okay? Rub myself into the dirt and extinguish myself. No. You know, we're fulfilling our own purposes, and what you think of, you know, what's your highest purpose? Yeah, your highest aim. We want to be able to purify our own mind and gain all the good qualities. Okay, so what they call the abandonments of the Buddha, the realizations of the Buddha. Okay, so these, when we... you know, the realizations go more on the side of the wisdom, dharmakaya, having the omniscient mind, yeah. And then the abandonment goes more on the side of the nature dharmakaya, abandoning all the afflictions and all the cognitive obscurations. Okay, and so in that way, we're perfecting ourselves or fulfilling our own aim. Yeah. So don't think Buddhism, you know. Buddhahood is, you know, all for others. We have to do something for ourselves to make ourselves capable of being of benefit. So what we do for ourselves is we actualize the Dharmakaya. And then from that comes fulfilling the two form bodies, which are said to fulfill the purposes or aims of others. Why? Because with the enjoyment body, we're able to lead the Arya Bodhisattvas, and with the emanation body we can lead all the ordinary sentient beings. Okay? So they say Buddhahood is the fulfillment of our own aims and the aims of others. Which is nice, isn't it? You know, it's not somehow skewed in some way. And it's acknowledging that, you know, we need to get ourselves in shape before we can be of any real benefit to others. So then there were some questions people left me. Yeah. So the first question was, why is, you know, in the when we talk about the heaviness, just the natural heaviness of the different actions, when we talk about the three physical ones, the heaviest is killing, then stealing, then sexual misconduct of speech, heaviest is lying, then creating disharmony, then harsh speech, then idle talk. In terms of the mind, the heaviest is wrong views, then maliciousness, and then covetousness. So returning to the three of the body, somebody's asking, why is unwise and unkind sexual behavior not heavier than stealing, because so much damage is done by rape and child abuse and so on. Okay, so why isn't it considered heavier than stealing? Okay, so I think there's several reasons going on here. First of all, if you think of ancient Indian culture, and many cultures actually, including our own until not so many years ago, girls were married off quite young. Yeah, in ancient India, you know, you got married, you legally got married or betrothed when you were a child, and then as soon as you hit puberty, boing, you know. So I don't think there was so much attention put on child abuse then, because, you know, the kids got married very, very early. Yeah. Also, the rule, you know, the perspectives, how they describe this was mostly written by men, not by women. Yeah. And also, you know, I think if you look at just the action itself, if people's possessions are stolen, they can die. Yeah? If your money's stolen, if your food's stolen, if you're living a hand-to-mouth existence, and somebody steals your things, you die. Yeah? So it's, stealing is very, very serious. Yeah? Compared to that, unwise and unsexual, you know, behavior, usually you're not going to die from it. And if you do, it's because it went over into killing. And it's that negativity and not just sexual abuse. Okay? Okay. So that doesn't mean it's okay to do that. It's just saying, you know, in terms of the harm. And also I think because you know, probably more women suffer from sexual abuse. It doesn't affect the entire population the same way as stealing can, because anybody, you know, and everybody can have their stuff stolen.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what you think about this idea, because I've been thinking about the same question. Mm-hmm. And what I decided is that sexual misconduct makes sense to me to fall in that order if you're talking about going outside of your marriage and consenting adults, but I actually decided that for some situations that rape and some of these things actually border on torture. Mm-hmm. And I put them in the physical category.
Yeah, actually some women, you know, nowadays are saying that some of the sexual abuse is, it has nothing to do with sex, it has to do with physical violence. And it just happens to be sexual in nature. But like you said, if it's torturing or something like that, yeah, for sure, it goes more in that category.
Physical harm.
Yeah. Okay, then there's another question here. We're coming to this topic in our studies, but I'll answer the question now and then we'll go through it again when we come to it, because you may have to hear it twice. So the question is, she's reading from Geshe Zofa's book, and he says, covetousness, coveting, malice, and wrong views are the core of cause or source from which an intention arises. Okay, and saying that the other seven non-virtues, we hear that the affliction is either one or... Well, anyway, what the question boils down to, okay, is these last three are said to be paths of action, but they're also afflictions, and they're said to motivate intentions, but they aren't intentions and they aren't actions. So what are they? Okay, so they're afflictions. Yeah. Now, well, let me read what Geshe Zopa wrote and then I'll explain it. So he said the three mental karmas, coveting, malice, and wrong view, are only karmic paths. They are not karma. Okay? Now, the way he said why he says they're karmic paths is a little bit different than I've heard before. He says these are karmic paths because they are the cause or the source from which an intention arises. And I've heard they're called karmic paths because when done with the branches, they are the paths to future rebirths. Yeah, whether you're, you know, the negative ones are the paths to the lower realms, the virtuous ones are the path to the higher realms. Okay, so, but they're not karma, okay? Because karma is action, usually. You know, it is action. And how the different schools define karma is slightly different. We'll get into it here. He says malice, for example, is not itself an intention, but is the underlying cause from which an intention arises. So if you remember the Lowig studies, every consciousness has the mental factor of intention. Remember, it's one of the five phenomenal presences. Yeah. So what he's saying here is malice, for example, is not an intention, it's an affliction. But when that affliction is in the mind, yeah, you have a primary mind, you have the five omnipresent mental factors. When that affliction arises, it affects that mental factor of intention. Okay, so malice, you're angry, then that makes the mental intention arise of wanting to retaliate. Okay, or wanting to get away, or, you know, whatever it is you want to do. Okay? So it is a karmic path because it is a cause of an intentional thought, but it is not a karma because it is not itself an intention to act. Okay? So the mental factor of intention is karma. Some schools say that's all karma is just that. The Prasangika and the Vipassaka also say it's the physical and verbal actions that come, that are motivated by that intention. But the mental factor of intention is the karma. So the affliction comes in the mind. It provokes an intention, which is the karma, the mental karma. That intention then can stimulate a verbal or a physical action, which is also called karma in those two schools. Okay? Yeah, because the malice, the coveting, the wrong views are not an intention to act themselves. They're afflictions. Okay? So he goes on, this distinction is drawn a little more clearly and the Abhidharma system of Vasubandhu's treasury of knowledge, where it is made in terms of karma and obscuring afflictions. So intention, or karma, and obscuring afflictions, or klesha, yeah, klesha, are mutually exclusive, meaning that whatever is an intention is not an affliction, whatever is an affliction is not an intention. There's nothing that can be both of them. Okay? So the three non-virtues of mind are afflictions, but they are not karma. Okay, so an obscuring affliction is the mistaken thought that precedes and gives rise to an intention, which is karma. So it's the cause or the source or the creator of karma, but it is not the karma itself. Because remember, we always hear that karma is created by afflictions. So this is how it is, yeah. The karma is the intention. And then, like I said, for some schools, they we'll get into it a little bit later, then verbal and physical actions are also karma. Okay, does that make sense now? Yeah.
Well, we've also said that karma is action. So Geshe Zopa said karma is intention, and karma is also action.
Action means intention.
Okay, synonymous.
Yeah. Karma, when you translate it, is action. But the definition of karma is intention.
For all schools, or just
for schools? Well, all schools agree with that part of it, but then the Vaibhasika and the Prasangika say that also physical and verbal actions are also karma. The Satantrikas and Chittamajans don't agree with that.
So the intention as a definition for karma isn't
basic. Yeah, I would say they agree with that part of it, but then they add more to it. Yeah. Okay, so we're on the three afflictions. And so it's interesting here, the three, you know, that are of mind, because what's interesting is all three of them, even though they were afflictions, can be motivated by any of the three poisons. So we'll get into that, okay? So mental factor, mental karma is the mental factor of intention, okay? Occurring simultaneously with coveting, ill will, and distorted views. But those three themselves are afflictions.
Can you say that?
Okay, mental karma is the mental factor of intention that occurs simultaneously with those three, but those three, or occurs motivated by those three. You know, within the same, you know, they have the same primary mind and they share five things in common. Yeah. Okay, so coveting, the object is an external possession, so it can be movable or immovable, or internal qualities. So it could be, you know, somebody's toothbrush, but it could also be somebody's intelligence, okay? Or their faith or whatever it is. So the worst form of it is desiring the offerings made to holy beings and to the Sangha. And it's not so difficult to generate that kind of coveting, yeah? When you see, like, at a long life puja, you know, so many statues being given, so many rugs, so many things. It's very easy to think, oh, you know, they're receiving so many, I wish I could have one. Yeah? Not that hard. Or you look at something really nice on the altar, yeah? And you say, boy, that would be really nice. Then the second part, so you have to recognize the object, you know, that you're coveting, and have the wish to possess somebody else's property or somebody else's good quality. And it can be motivated by any of the three poisons. So, yeah, when I've thought about it, because these themselves are the three poisons, they're the affliction. What do you mean they're motivated by it? Okay, is that These are, sometimes they talk about the original cause and the immediate cause of something, yeah? So the original cause can be one thing and then it morphs into the immediate cause. So let's say you're really, really angry at somebody. Yeah, you're really mad. And then you say, oh, I want to get even. I know I really want to take their new jewelry that they got because that'll hurt them. So the original started off, the original motivation started as anger, but then it changed into coveting. Okay. And then the actual action here, it isn't just the passing thought of, oh, I want somebody's, you know, jewelry. They have those marvelous pop beads. Remember pop beads? Yeah. When you're a little kid, the little necklaces you made out of pop beads. So there's this wonder, they have these wonderful pop beads. Yeah. So I want their pop beads. Yeah. So it's not just the passing thought of, gee, that would be nice to have. It's more, it's like, you know how in the Four Immeasurables, we start out how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings had happiness. May they have happiness and causes. I will cause them to have happiness and causes. And then Guru Buddha, please inspire me to be able to do so. So it's like that. You know, how wonderful it would be if I could have their pop beads and roller skates. May I have their pop beads and roller skates. I will make it so that I can get my their pop beads and roller skates. But this one, you can't do the fourth one. You can't ask the Buddha's blessing for it. Okay, but it's that same kind of progression. So it's not just the random thought of desire. It's something that's built up over some time. Not just how nice, but you know, may I have it? I will do something to get it. Okay? So it's, you know, it's coming into a quite a strong motivation that's striving to accomplish that purpose. Yeah. So this is often what happens when we go shopping or just walking in the shopping mall. Okay? You're just walking, oh, I'm just... no, I don't need anything. I'm just going there to meet my friends and have fun. And you walk, and then you see something. Oh, that's really pretty. And you keep walking. Then you come back. Oh, how wonderful it would be if I could have that. No, but I can't afford it. So you keep walking. And your mind says, oh, may I have that? You walk back again. Yeah, that's really good. May I have that? I'm gonna get it. Yeah, credit card debt or not, I'm getting this. Okay, so the strong motivation like that, okay? So that's coveting, yeah. So it involves, you know, planning. You start to plan how you can get it. So it may motivate you to buy something legally. It may motivate you to steal something. It can motivate a lot of different kind of actions. It can motivate lying. You know, you want something, so you lie to get it. Or you want something, you know, because you're jealous of somebody, so you speak harsh words to them, or you talk behind their back and ruin their reputation, or something like that. So it can be property in your own family, it can be others' things, it can be stuff which doesn't really belong to anybody. Yeah. Although there's not much stuff like that in the world left anymore. Yeah, it could be somebody else's qualities, you really want to have those qualities. Okay. Then, malicious, malice, So, here it's against sentient beings. I suppose you could have malice for an inanimate object, like when your car isn't working or your computer's not working. It's like this beep, 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 beep thing. Yeah, you're really mad. Okay. So, you know, the recognition is you recognize it as somebody that could be harmed or hurt if you harm them. You want to harm, you want to take revenge, you want to do something damaging to the other person. And then for the intention, you know, you can see it could start out, the initial intention could start out, let's say, with attachment. Yeah, you're very attached to somebody, but they're talking to somebody else. So you get angry at them, or you get angry at the person they're talking to. Okay, but it starts out as attachment. Yeah. Can start out as ignorance, thinking, you know, nothing wrong with, you know, I'm kind of bored today, I think I'll sit around and, you know, think of how I can have some excitement by harming somebody. So then, you know, again, it's not just this thought passing through your mind of, you know, of anger, like, oh, I can't stand that person. That's not this one. It's like, you know, I want to harm them. Yeah, it's like, how wonderful it would be if I could get my intention, if I could get my revenge. Yeah, how wonderful that would be. And then, you know, may I get my revenge? And then, oh, I have this great plan. Yeah, I know exactly what I can do to really hurt their feelings. Okay. And we do this, don't we? You can spend a whole meditation session on it. Yeah, even more than one meditation session. You know, when we hold grudges for a long time, when we hold animosity against people, then sometimes it just pops up seemingly out of nowhere of like, we're mad and we want to let them know it. We want to hurt their feelings. We want them to have a taste of their own medicine. So we don't say to ourselves, I want revenge or I'm a vengeful person. Because that sounds like really awful, doesn't it? You know, I want revenge. What cultured person would say that? You know, or I'm very vengeful. You know, that's what nasty, horrible people do. I'm not one of those. So we don't say that to ourselves, like I want revenge. But I just want them to know what my experience is. Yeah? And so if they felt hurt, you know, then they would know what my experience was. And, you know, I'd have some pleasure, and maybe it would even prompt them to come groveling on the floor and apologize to me. Yeah. Of course, when's that gonna happen? But we like to think it will help. So we plan how to hurt them or how to harm them physically, you know, just because we hate them, we're mad at them. Yeah, I mean, this is what they educate you to do in the military, isn't it? Yeah, you have an enemy and you are educated to destroy that enemy. Yeah, in order to help some other people. Okay, so it could be, you know, jealousy or rivalry, so you want to harm somebody. It could even be wanting, holding a grudge even though somebody's apologized to you. That's really awful, isn't it? Somebody's apologized and we don't forgive them and we still are mad and we still want to hurt them. We want to get even. Okay, so we started doing this when we were maybe 2-3 years old, and we perfected it, this method. We perfected the malice, you know, over quite a number of years. And now we see it in the presidential debates. I mean, the way people are talking to each other, it's worse than a bunch of kids in junior high, in middle school. It's awful. The way the people, these are adults who want to be leaders, and the way they're talking about each other and to each other, yeah, is filled with this kind of malice. And it's really kind of shocking to me that voters would be impressed with people who have that kind of anger and malice and let it come out of their mouths the way they do. Because to me, you know, when I see people who act like that, it's like I don't want to get near them because you know that you're going to be one of their targets before long. And yet, you know, you see these people speak to each other like that, and then everybody applauds. It's really rather shocking. Yeah, I find it, yeah, quite shocking. Okay, so that's, you know, then it involves this element of planning, and then the completion is deciding to inflict the harm. Similar with coveting, you know, the action is planning, building up that intention. The completion is, you know, deciding to go get that thing. So it's all done mentally. The action of going to get it, the action of harming somebody else, that becomes a physical action. So this is all just the mental part. It can be quite powerful, and we can spend a good part of our day on these three mental ones, you know, even when we're keeping silence. Geshe Dzogchen Tenchok used to, he comment a lot, you know, to the monks and nuns about the coveting one, you know, because he'd say, oh, you go in somebody's house, and then, you know, because in the West it's kind of considered polite to look at all somebody's things, isn't it? Yeah, and to comment on how beautiful they are, and to have a little bit of, you know, envy and wish that I could have those things, and to convey that to the other person then is flattered. That's strange. Flattered by our non-virtue. So, you know, he was saying that, you know, especially as monastics, we need to be very careful with this. Because otherwise we go in somebody's house and it's like, oh, what a beautiful book you have. What a beautiful mug you have. You know, what a beautiful table you have. Oh, you have such a lovely rock collection. I really like your tonkas. Where did you get your tonkas? Hint, hint, hint. And it can easily, you know, the coveting one can easily, you know, go downhill into hinting, into flattery, into hypocrisy, coercion, you know. Very easily it can go down that slippery slope. So he said we should be careful about that one. And I would say also about the malice one too. How many of you find in your meditation that you have more distraction towards attachment objects than towards things you're mad at? Okay. And how many of you find that you anger comes up in meditation more than attachment? Yeah. What was it? You didn't raise your hand. So, yeah, so you can see that we may be more inclined towards one than the other. But they're both distracting from meditation. I And you can spend a long time on both of them. Okay, then wrong views. Yeah. So this is the object is something that's true and that exists, and you're stubbornly refuting it or denying it. Okay? So there's three kinds. You can deny a cause. So for example, saying there's no such thing as constructive and destructive actions. You know, what we do now does not, you know, have an ethical dimension. It does not influence our future. There's, you know, the causes like this don't exist. Denying an effect would be saying there's no effect of our actions. Okay, so, just stop free. There's no effect. Or denying a functioning. So things like saying that things happen without a cause. Or you deny things that exist. For example, saying there's no past and future lives. There's no other realms of existence. There's no mind. Everything is the brain, or an emergent property of the brain. Saying there's no such thing as Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. They don't exist. Yeah. Awakening is a fantasy story that they invented to keep, to manipulate people and make them be good. So deny things like that exist. Okay? No such things as arhats, bodhicitta is just a bunch of garbage. No, that kind of thing. Many people talk like this, don't they? Sometimes even people who call themselves Buddhists. Okay, so you know, then the second part of it, you know, the attitude is you know clearly what you disbelieve. You intend to deny that thing, and then again, any of the three poisons. So, by attachment, you know, maybe you're hanging out with a certain group of people who seem rather, you know, chic, and you want to be in with them, and they're denying these things, so motivated by attachment, then your ignorance flares up, you deny them too. Or maybe motivated by anger, you're mad at your friend who's a Buddhist. Yeah. Some Buddhist came up to you and said, you know, you're creating negative karma and going to hell. So you get really mad at them and you say, I don't believe in that rubbish. Yeah? So motivated by anger. But mostly motivated by just plain old ignorance and confusion. Okay? So this kind of attitude is, you know, there's no integrity, you're completely oblivious to the faults of wrong views. I mean, we're oblivious to the faults of coveting and malice, but we kind of know that they're not so good, you know, because you know, when there's intense craving in our mind, one part of our mind says, yeah, that's not so good, and especially when there's intense hatred. But when we have wrong views, we completely believe them. There's no mental, you know, nothing in the mind that says, oh, maybe this isn't true, or maybe, you know, you're damaging yourself by thinking like this. No, there's none of that. It's like, this makes sense to me, this is what I believe. Okay, then the action itself is thinking of the wrong view again and again. And then the completion of it is deciding that this thing doesn't exist. There's no such thing as karma and its effects. There's no such thing as liberation. Yeah. There's no such thing as you know, great compassion, because people are inherently selfish. We're hardwired to be selfish. So great compassion is, you know, it's from Peter Pan. Okay, so it's not just doubting or disbelieving something, it's actively deciding that you're going to refute or deny it. Okay, so it's not just doubt, like, yeah, I'm not sure, or I don't know about that one, doesn't make much sense to me. It's like, no, this is completely false, this is hogwash. So there's a certain amount of stubbornness, there's contentiousness mixed in, there can be meanness, there can be arrogance. Actually, a lot of arrogance sometimes comes with wrong views. You know, I don't believe that rubbish, I know what's best, because I'm intelligent, and this is, you know, what I believe, which is the opposite of that stuff. And I've been thinking a lot about wrong views, you know, because it came up in Precious Garland. Remember at the beginning? Remember the simile of the cows walking, following the lead cow near the cliff? Okay. And just thinking, you know, especially with wrong views, and we can follow the cows in front of us doing any kind of non-virtuous action. But especially with wrong views, it's so easy, you know? And there, you know, you meet Charlottenanda and you take teachings from Charlottenanda. Somebody once wrote me and said, who's Charlottenanda? Yeah. What Dharma Center says he is he bad? I don't want to go there. Okay. So, you know, but you have Charlottenanda as your lama, and they say this, that, and the other thing, and maybe they're charismatic, or they're good looking, or they tell lots of jokes and good stories. And there's a nice group of people around them, and you want to be part of that group. So you just adopt the view, you know, that they have. And they say that wrong views of all 10 is the worst one, which at the beginning may seem rather strange to us because it's only a mental one. Surely killing somebody is worse. Not really in the long term, because if you have wrong views, yeah, with certain wrong views, your view will give you permission to do the other 9. Yeah? If you have certain wrong views, like the people who think that animal sacrifice is pleasing to the gods, that wrong view gives them permission to slaughter animals. Look at ISIS, you know? If I kill the enemy, then I will be born in heaven. I will be blessed by God. I mean, what an incredible view that leads you to so much killing. Yeah? So much stealing, so much unwise and unconsexual behavior, and all the whole rest of them, just by the power of that wrong view. Yeah? So it's very, very important to watch this. And, you know, just in watching how Buddhism is coming to America, it's really kind, it's, for me, it's very concerning, because there's many people you meet who call themselves Buddhist, but then what they believe is not what the Buddha taught, and sometimes it's the opposite of what the Buddha taught. And that's what they're teaching. In which case, I wonder why they call themselves Buddhist. Just call yourself, make up your own religion. Yeah? Well, why teach it under the label of Buddhism? So I heard an interview by one of these people. The interviewer asked him, you know, why are you calling yourself Buddha? And he said, well, I still have regard for what the Buddha said, and I really admire, you know, Nagarjuna's philosophy and what's said in the sutras.
Which part?
Well, that's the thing, you know, that they're picking and choosing. And I thought, you know, because they were saying, you know, no such thing as rebirth, or they don't want to come out and say it like that, I'm agnostic, or you don't need to believe it, or, you know, talking about results happening in future lives, you know, we don't need that kind of thing. Yeah. So that's just, you know, we don't need, yeah, these things are unnecessary, and we can't prove them, and so just leave them aside. Yeah. But I thought, I was thinking, wow, you say you appreciate Nagarjuna, but Nagarjuna, you know, taught the middle way between nihilism and absolutism. And sounds to me what you're espousing is going towards the nihilistic end. Yeah. So that's quite interesting. And I think I've told many times this Buddhist conference I went to about 6-7 years ago, where they had us do this exercise. And like there were half of the people there who called themselves Buddhist teachers who did not believe in rebirth. Yeah, and did not believe in other realms. I mean, the animal realm we can see. But yeah, so not even kind of agnostic, but like, I don't believe in that. So I thought that that's very strange. So when Buddhism was going to another place, and these kind of things happen. So it was interesting for me, you know, being in India with His Holiness, and there's a whole group of Westerners and non-Tibetans there. And but all those people who were coming to hear His Holiness, I think they all had a sense of faith in what His Holiness was teaching. Maybe we don't understand the whole thing, but there's some sense that, you know, this is really true and we want to learn it and we want to practice it. And I was thinking how different that is sometimes from people who just learn the Dharma in the West, who don't have the opportunity to meet people like His Holiness. Yeah, and so they're getting a little here and a little there. And so it's not a thing, people could say, it sounds like, you know, unless you believe what the Buddha taught, you're going to hell. Isn't that just like all the other religions? Yeah. And I remember, you know, because Lama Sopa, you know, he learned English a lot by just looking in dictionaries. Yeah. So his first translation of Wrong Views, according to the dictionary, was heresy. So I remember being in my first course, and you know, and heresy is negative karma, and I'm going, ay, 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 Joan of Arc burning at the stage, the Jews being kicked out of Spain, you know, and being exterminated. I mean, the word heresy is like intense, isn't it? Are your connotations of heresy what mine are? It's like, you know, they're killing people because of what they believe. They're heretics. And I was like, I think sometimes he still says it too. Yeah? Yeah? And you heard it more recently. So, yeah. So it's not a Buddhist version of heresy. It's not, that's not what it is. It's not, you know, we have the one truth, and you're not accepting our truth, therefore you're a heretic and you're going to hell. No, that's not what the Buddha's teaching here. That's not the meaning of Wrong Views. It's not, you know, here's the catechism and you've got to profess. Yeah, please don't, you know. Let me tell you, if Buddhism were like that, I would have gone the other direction real fast. Yeah. No, it's more, you know, think about things. Think about causality. Yeah. Do things happen totally randomly, or are there causes? How does the mind affect your experience? Are there different realms of existence, like the animal realm? Okay. Can human beings be born as an animal? Sometimes we say they act worse than animals. So can't they be born as an animal if they act worse than an animal? So, you know, we're encouraged to think about things and to learn. And then, of course, a lot of these things, well, some of these things, like about karma, you know, you have to cultivate depending on scripture. But even to rely on scripture, you have to see if it's a reliable scripture. Yeah. And there's the criteria for testing a scripture to see if it's reliable or not. So it's not just, you know, the Buddha said this, don't you dare criticize it. It's, you know, think about things. And as we've been noticing, most of it comes back to emptiness. Yeah? If we can understand emptiness, then a lot of the other things really fall into place. Okay. So, any questions about these three that we've done? Last three?
I'm kind of surprised the way they define the wrong views. It makes sense to me, but I just was surprised until I read it, because it takes it from denying something that exists, but it doesn't take it from the view of people proposing the positive, you know, like their assertions, like, you know, animal liberation is the way, your animal sacrifice is the way to go, you know.
Yeah.
But I guess it kind of includes everything by doing it that way.
Yeah, it speaks about it from the negative way, denying things. But I think it also includes, you know, oh, there's a creator God who, you know, makes everything happen. Or animal sacrifice is good. Or, you know, if you're a Brahmin, you have special privileges to steal or kill or whatever. You know, whatever.
And the other thing I wanted to ask you about, I remember it was the last retreat or something where it was, I mean, I asked something about mysticism, and remember he had something in the Q&A about mysticism, I can't remember, and I was thinking what you said once about that you don't really believe in that so much as we don't understand the causes sometimes.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that that's what makes sense to me in terms of a lot of these things, is that even with syllogism, at some point any of these things, any of these reasonings come back at some point to our direct experience.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of an important point, I think.
Yeah. That all the reasoning has to come back to experience in one way or another.
Yeah.
And what I had said is what we call magic, we call things magic because we don't know the dependent arising that caused them. What do you mean by mysticism?
Yeah, well, that was the question I was asking.
Yeah, because I think mysticism can mean so many different things to different people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, some people are mystics and they're really seeing like things that exist that the rest of us don't see. And some people are mystics and they're hallucinating. So,
yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting that in the teachings this last year, there was one thing where the Pamukkha Rinpoche talked about three kinds of visions that people can have. So he said one is just hallucinations caused by the winds, the way the winds are flowing in the channels. Yeah. And then the second one is like a vision in meditation of the deity. And then the third one is a vision where you actually, the second one, you know, in meditation is with your mental consciousness. The third one is actually with your sense consciousness, as you can meet the deity. And he said that's the one that Jay Rinpoche had with Manjushri. But being able to tell, you know, those three, especially the first two, or the first one and the third one, to tell them apart, I mean, you need some expertise to be able to do that. And in any case, they say it's nothing really to get excited about. Yeah. That it's more just use it to encourage yourself to say, wow, you know, I've never had that experience before. Now I know that kind of thing is possible. I don't know if that was actually Tara or not, but, you know, whatever it was, it's an experience I haven't had, and if I use it in the right way, it'll stimulate me to practice. Whereas if you use it in the wrong way, it becomes a total distraction to practice. I had a vision of, you know, Manjushri, and he appeared to me, and I must be very close to enlightenment, you know, something like that. Yeah, then that's going to be a big obstacle. Yeah.
So that Genesis vibrates with the after lunch recitation, where they say, you know, if you do any of these things, meditation, study, whatever, with the eight worldly dharmas, you know, uh-huh. Forget it. Right. So same thing with visions. If you use your visions to support your eight worldly dharmas.
Yeah, yeah. So, because I once asked Bhari Rinpoche when I first met him many, many years ago, because people, when I was in Singapore, were always asking me about visions and dreams and, you know, all these kinds of, what is it?
Paranormal.
Yeah, well, paranormal things and, you know, things with spirits and stuff like that. And, I never knew what to say. So I asked Pari Mirvache, you know, when these people ask me this, what is a skillful way to answer to help these people? And he said, you know, you can't validate it, you can't negate it, but you just give them an explanation that will help them, that will encourage them in the Dharma. Like, you know, oh, that was a very nice dream. Wouldn't it be nice if you could have that kind of compassion in your regular life too? And, you know, really work in your meditation practice to develop that compassion, or, you know, something like that. Because, and you can see that in some way it doesn't really matter if these things are true or not. The real thing that's important is how you interpret them and how you use them. It's kind of like with placebos in medicine, in a way, isn't it? No? So.
Well, there's a question online.
Okay.
Someone asked, I thought to be a practicing Buddhist, you had to believe in rebirth and the realms that one can be born into.
Okay. There's somebody saying to be a practicing Buddhist, you have to believe in rebirth in the different realms. There's no... When you become a Buddhist, when you take refuge, there's nothing that you have to sign that says, I believe in this and this and this. Yeah. There's no requirement from any religious institution that you have to believe anything. Yeah. It's completely up to you. And I remember His Holiness once saying, that some people say that to take refuge and officially, because refuge is the demarcation of becoming a Buddhist, that you should believe in rebirth. But His Holiness said, you know, yes, I can see that. Maybe for some people that works. But, you know, for other people, they can become Buddhist with the motivation just to have a kind heart. And if they have that as a strong motivation to develop a kind heart, and Buddhist techniques help them to develop a kind heart, he said, then I think that's fine if they take refuge. So, you know, you have a strict interpretation by the book, and you have a practical interpretation for the modern world. Okay? And he'll probably answer that question differently according to who he's talking to. So it's interesting, you know, that it's the person is kind of implying, like these people who don't believe in rebirth, you know, how dare you call yourself a Buddhist? I'm going to take your refuge card away from you. You're no Buddhist. There, you know, there's nothing like that in Buddhism at all. Okay. It's completely up to the individual. And also, you know, the whole Buddhist perspective is that people are not concrete, immutable entities, that you start out at one level, and as you learn more, you progress, and what you believe changes and how you act change. I was talking to somebody not too long ago, I can't remember who, but we were saying that when we first took refuge, we didn't have any clue what it was about compared to what we know now. You know, I mean, think about when you first took refuge. And think about what refuge means to you now. There's a big difference, isn't there? Huge difference. And, you know, in another 5 years or 10 years, there will be also another huge difference. So, you know, Buddhism looks at it very much as you start where you're at, and then you do some learning, you do some practice, and then you grow. And things that didn't make sense to you before come to make sense to you. If you hang in there. If you throw up your hands and say, it's up to them to prove it to me, instead of it's up to me to think. If you just say, well, they haven't proven to me, so then you're not going to get anywhere. But if you say, you know, it's up to me to investigate and to study and learn and think about these things, then, you know, there will definitely be some transformation.
There, but also in response to that, there's no, you don't have to sign anything, there's also no teacher certification program. And so, the Buddhist teachers who don't believe in those basic tenets, I mean, that's part of our responsibility, too, is to check out.
So right, okay. So, good point. So, just as there's no, you know, chop for becoming a Buddhist, a seal of approval, there's no certification program for becoming a teacher. In Asia, it's a little bit, they don't get certified. They become geshis or kenpos. There is an educational process, and you do to get a degree after it. But even in Asia, there are many teachers who have not gone through that educational process who are teachers. But there, at least they have that educational process. Okay. Here in the West, there's no certification process. FPMT has a thing. They have different grades of teachers that they, you know, acknowledge within their own organization and their own students. And maybe other groups do as well, I'm not sure. But there's no national certification board of licenses for being a Buddhist teacher where you have to take a test and you have to put your hand on a sutra and, you know, and things like that. So what that means, as you pointed out, is that means that it's really up to us to investigate the qualities of the teacher, of a teacher, and not assume that everybody who is called a teacher is a teacher or has to be our teacher. You know, it's really a thing of we have to investigate, and then we choose.
And you say it once in a teaching, it's not up to us to make ourselves to a teacher, it's our quality we practice and study, and then if
people are recognizing our qualities and want to, you know, perform us, then.
At one of the Western Buddhist conferences with His Holiness, people asked, you know, well, how do you become a lama? And he said, he didn't like the term lama so much, but just teacher. He said it's the students that make somebody a teacher. Yeah, that people see certain qualities or somebody has a certain, you know, body of knowledge, and people go to them and say, please teach me, and that's how somebody becomes a teacher. So you don't make yourself a teacher saying, you know, I'm going to, you know, set up a shingle and start an organization and make myself a teacher. But what's tricky about that is when the students don't know what qualities to look for in the teacher. That's the tricky thing. And that's what's difficult in the West right now, is that people don't know the qualities to look for and the qualities to really be careful of, too. Yeah? So, that's the thing. And so he says that, you know, there's bound to be a lot of confusion at the beginning because of that. And hopefully as people gain more knowledge and have less fascination, that then they'll be able to choose teachers better. Or, you know, maybe there will be some kind of certification process. I can't see them doing it for all Tibetan Buddhists together. I don't think anybody would agree to that. But maybe within certain groups, those different groups will do it.
One thing I have observed in Europe is that many organizations have asked, like His Holiness or the Karmapa, to be how to translate it, something like an umbrella for their organization. So whenever they make a main decision, then they have to ask this person to set that in motion.
Yeah.
So that is one proof, you know, when you have His Holiness there as the main.
Yeah. Well, you know, His Holiness doesn't like to be called the spiritual advisor to any groups.
Yeah.
He declines that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because he can't monitor everything all these different groups do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But you're right that people will often choose somebody, I mean the head of the organization, if they have an international organization, the head of that organization, very often major decisions have to be okayed by that person. But then sometimes, you know, when you have a huge organization, then the teacher becomes an administrator if everything has to go through them and they have no time to teach. Okay, should we stop here for tonight? And then next week we'll go on. We'll talk about naturally. Oh, you know what I did want to do? Let's not stop quite yet. Let's read through the Gongshen Mongren and see what it says. But first, I have to call it up. To go back to the beginning about the ten. Who has the tablet?
That's where we started, at the basis of madness.
Yeah, but let's go back to the beginning of the ten.
4B, 2B, page 14.
Okay, let me just call it up here. Okay. Okay, so, so the actual non-virtuous karmic paths. Regarding all 10 non-virtues, starting with killing, the way to analyze them is from the angle of the basis, intention, and action. So he's putting it as three parts. But actually, when you go into it, the way he's putting it is more than that. Anyway, for killing, the basis is another sentient being, and the affliction and the motivation constitute the intention. Here's where I'm the translation I think is a bit weird. The affliction is any of the three poisons, and then the motivation is the wish to kill. Okay, so that part makes sense. And then you recognize a sentient being to be so and so, which is the identification of the object. And then when the motivation is to kill, in general, even if mistaken with respect to the object, there will be non-virtue. So whoever you kill, there's non-virtue even if you kill the wrong person. Okay? The action is stabbing, poisoning, using black magic, and so forth, whether you do it yourself or have someone else do it. It is said that for completion, the victim must die due to the action before you do. The principle of the general motivation is the same for the remaining nine, meaning that there's the motivation to do that action. Okay. So the basis of theft is property owned by somebody else within the intention, identification of the object, and the affliction are similar to killing. I mean, you have to identify properly, you have the same kind of afflictions. The motivation is the wish to deprive the owner of the property that has not been given to you. The action is accomplished by either forceful or crafty means, whether you do it yourself or have somebody else do it. Moreover, regarding things put into your care, debts, and so forth, when you deceive someone, in most cases, it is equivalent to theft. Okay, so you borrow something, then you don't return it, that kind of thing. It is taught that completion occurs when the component that is a thought of ownership arises. So you think, this is now mine. The basis for sexual misconduct are unsuitable sexual partners, such as your mother, or somebody who's in a relationship with somebody else. We would nowadays say children as well, or people who don't consent. Unsuitable orifices, the mouth, anus, and so forth. Unsuitable locations before a stupa, your teacher, and so on. That part made sense, you know. Don't go to a Dharma center and start, I had a friend who worked at Cloud Mountain, and he was the office manager, and he was telling me what some of the retreatants there did. come for a retreat, and they're up in they had the building in the top of the hill, remember? And so. And then unsuitable timings during pregnancy, when one-day precepts have been taken, and the like. Within the thinking for the former non-virtues, identification must be unmistaken. Okay, but for sexual relations, it is said that it is the same regardless of it being mistaken. So if you intend to sleep with X and you sleep with Y, there's no difference. But in the treasury, however, a different explanation is given. So treasury of knowledge, Vasubandhu. So he says he must identify the person correctly. The affliction may be any of the three poisons. The motivation is the wish for sexual relations in the form of sexual misconduct. The action is striving to that end, and its completion is the meeting of the two organs. Okay, the bases for lying are what you saw, and then it says the eight. Okay, so the eight bases of lying are the seen, what's been seen, what's been heard, what's been distinguished, and what's been cognized, and then you lie about what hasn't been seen, what hasn't been heard, what hasn't been distinguished, and what hasn't been cognized. And so that's the basis, and the interlocutors, the other person hearing it, within the intention. Intention is confusing to say here. It's better to say like attitude or motivation, because intention is that mental factor. Identification is transformation of what you saw into what you did not see, a so forth. The affliction is as above. The motivation is the wish to speak according to the transformed identification. The action is speaking or concurring, or not, I guess, speaking, not speaking, but making it evident that you concur. It is the same when you express yourself with physical gestures or signals. Whether you say for your sake or someone else's, it is lying just the same. So we can't say, but I did it for my friend. Can't do that. So for all three, lying, divisive speech, and harsh words as well, it is said that having someone do it for you is also a karmic path. However, according to the Vinaya, you must do it yourself. So that makes sense. I mean, also for the three physical ones in Vinaya, to be a transgression of a precept, you have to do the action yourself. Yeah. Telling someone else to do it is negative karma, but you're not going to have a parajika by telling somebody else to do it. Okay. Completion occurs when another person understands what you say. When the three lying and so forth are not understood, so this means lying, disharmonious speech and harsh words. When somebody doesn't understand them, then they become senseless talk. But idle talk, senseless talk, doesn't matter whether they understand you or not. The basis of divisive speech are harmonious or inharmonious sentient beings within the attitude, intention, and affliction are the same as for lying. The motivation is the wish to separate the harmonious or to impede the reconciliation of the inharmonious. The action can be speaking truthfully or lying, speaking pleasantly or speaking unpleasantly. You can do so yourself or have others do it. So completion occurs when the divisive words pronounced are understood. So reading through this is a good review of what we did. For harsh speech, the basis is a sentient being towards whom you feel hostile. The two components of the attitude are the same as before. The motivation is the wish to speak harshly. The action is to speak unpleasantly, either truthfully or untruthfully, regarding the imperfections of someone's family, their body, their ethical discipline, their looks, their intelligence, whatever you want to criticize. Completion occurs when the person addressed has understood what you said. For meaningless talk, the basis is a pointless subject matter. Within the inharmonious, there's identification of the topic you wish to speak of as such. The inharmonious, it should be meaningless. The affliction is any of the three mental poisons. And the motivation is the wish to engage in senseless and futile talk. The action is to begin your empty chatter. Its completion, it is complete as soon as you have spoken pointlessly. So instead of inharmonious, let's...
In the original, it says within the thinking.
Within what?
The thinking.
Within the thinking. Maybe within what you're thinking.
You know how to go back?
No, I would say maybe change it within the attitude. Because where she has intention here, I would put attitude. Okay. The basis of coveting is another person's wealth or property. Within the attitude, identification consists of recognizing it as such. The affliction is one of the three poisons, and the motivation is the wish to possess it. The action is to pursue that goal, meaning pursuing it mentally. Completion occurs when, regarding the wealth and so on, whatever it may be, the thought arises, not may it be mine, but I'm going to get it. Okay, may it be mine is too light. Okay, the basis of malice and the first two components of the attitude are the same as for harsh speech. The motivation is the intention to strike someone and such, the wish for their belongings to deteriorate and so on. The action is to entertain such thoughts, and the completion occurs when you decide to strike someone or do whatever it is you're going to do. It is affirmed that the basis of wrong views is something that exists. Identification is the recognition of the truth of the object denied. The affliction is any of the three poisons. The motivation is the wish to deny its existence. The action is to pursue that goal. So it's denying the existence of the four causes, effects, things, and existence. So it is interesting that it's not saying, like, affirming something that is a wrong view. But of course, when you affirm something that's a wrong view, you're probably negating something that's the right view at the same time. Completion is to be certain of your denial. Okay, that actually goes with the last paragraph. And then the new paragraph should begin with mental karmas. Mental karmas are as intention, are karmas, not karmic paths. That's what we were talking about at the beginning. The seven physical and verbal karmas are karmas and karmic paths as well. The three, coveting and so forth, are karmic paths, but not karmas. An action that an intention instigates is necessarily a karmic path. Okay, so the physical and verbal things that an intention instigates are. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I have a question about the way this is written for this wrong views, that identification is the recognition of the truth of the object denied. It implies that you have to know
that your view is wrong. Yeah.
And I'm going to be stubborn about it anyway.
Yeah, I don't think that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Because if you really realized it was wrong, you wouldn't be thinking about it again and again and again.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's why I'm not so happy with this translation. Did you have something? Anybody else? Okay. So, that was the review. And now we'll stop, and then there's a few other points that we'll go into next time.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losam's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kambhiratayami.
Due to this merit, may
may soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Shenresi, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view